The following podcast reflects the views and opinions of the hosts and guests only. They do not reflect the views or opinions of any agency or specific members of an association. At times, colorful language may be used and may be unsuitable for people under the age of 18. Discretion is advised.
All right, we are here. It is our pleasure to bring in an old friend of mine, someone that anyone in the fighting community would know, and hopefully people in law enforcement community should know. Frank Mir, former UFC heavyweight champion, fought in UFC, fought in Bellator, one of the foremost heavyweight grapplers in the sport. Very knowledgeable, has been involved in law enforcement one way or another, whether it was through his father, through himself. Him and I did some things when we were young. We were 16 as explorers, and we're just really happy to have someone like Frank on here because we talk about the need for cops to train. There's a lot of cops that think they're tough. There's a lot of cops that think they can handle themselves. And the truth is when the chips are down, they may not know what to do at all. So, Frank, I'll let you introduce yourself for those that may not know you. If you don't know, you just probably shouldn't even be watching.
Yeah, thanks. No, you nailed it on the head. I'm basically a lifelong martial artist, born and raised in Las Vegas, and pretty much, you know, my claim to fame is that two-time UFC heavyweight champion and holder of several records, a lot of them being finishes and submissions.
All right. And if you can kind of tell people a little bit how law enforcement, even though you're not in law enforcement right now, how it kind of has impacted your life when you were young through your dad, yeah. And then kind of coming up, and maybe would you be doing law enforcement if you weren't a fighter?
No, actually, that's what I would have fell back on. In fact, I actually went out and even tested when I was 21, but I had already started turning pro, and it looked like money was going in that direction. So I thought, oh, I'll just put this on hold and follow a fight career, and then I can always come back to it, you know, like some guys on the force actually have. Then the wife, you know, she's like, no, nah, that's never happening. It's way too dangerous, which she does have a point. No one's shooting me inside the cage anytime soon.
And Frank, that leads us to one of our questions by a member, Officer Quintana, works at the airport. He wants to know if you are considering testing for the department.
No, I always still juggle back and forth with it, but I think now, right now, with my wife and the kids, and now with my daughter fighting professionally, it takes up so much of my time that I wouldn't be fully dedicated. And I think that being a police officer is it's a career choice where that's 24/7. You know, I don't think you ever really clock out. I think everything you're doing is constantly for that profession. So having that many kind of distractions, I think, would be a detriment.
Okay, and Frank, you said your daughter's fighting now. It's Bella.
Yeah.
Did she just have a fight, or is it a new thing that she signed?
Yeah, Bella's 17, so we actually had to fight out of the country for her first pro fight because for whatever reason, we could have boxed or kickboxed, but MMA, you had to wait till you're 18. So in Mexico, shocker, the legislation wasn't as strict.
Yeah.
And so when she went down there and had her first fight here October 22nd, just about 6 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and she won. She had a really tough girl that she fought, actually, that was 33 years old and had 10 fights experience on the amateur level. And this is Bella's first fight. I mean, she's multiple times state champion, a wrestler. She competes in jiu-jitsu. But this is the first time she's competed with, you know, people hitting her.
Good. And congratulations, Bella. We're all rooting for you here in the department. And you must be a proud dad.
Yeah, you know, I think that all parents want their children to find something that they love and be good at it. And if they can also be, you know, taken care of by it financially, then I think that's the trifecta. And, you know, my daughter has found that. It wasn't my first choice, but, you know, I tell people, I use this analogy all the time, that being a professional martial artist is like being a professional musician. Do I think music and understanding an instrument's good for you? Absolutely. Do I think you should go ahead and, you know, and drop out of college to follow a career as a rock star? Probably not going to work out for you. I mean, it could, and some people have made a great living at it, but for every rich guy you see on TV who made it as a musician, there's thousands of guys that didn't. And that's the same thing with the fight career, the fight world. You know, for everybody that's a superstar who's made money, I can show you countless individuals that now are, you know, they wasted their time pursuing other career choices that could have pushed. Not that they didn't still shouldn't train, but they put so much time and effort in one area that now, you know, it's too, you know, it's much more difficult for them to adapt to life as they get older. And but Bella, you know, she really wanted to do it. And then Ronda Rousey started fighting, and I seen that women could make money at it. And I was like, all right, well, this is the one area that my daughter can compete as an athlete where she can actually be equal to and even surpass a man as far as the equivalence of attention drawn. You know, if she plays football, there's female football leagues, there's another one starting up, but they're never going to be taken the same category or make the same financial as the male counterpart. I mean, you see it in soccer, you see it in basketball. So I think if you're a female athlete, sometimes that's a hard pill to swallow. Whereas within the fight world, it's not the case. We have women headlining cards all the time.
No, and I've seen it, and it seems like that's something that, you know, the other sports aren't as, it's not a successful thing.
No.
We also had a few other questions from members. Let me pull it up real quick. So we had a question about your dad. This question, your dad was in my academy. Yeah, I really enjoyed my time with him way back then. He's a really good dude. It's been a while. I retired after 30 years, but I couldn't find any info about your pops. Is he still kicking? Please tell me. Bo Neal says hello and God bless.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, I like the guy too. I'm pretty fond of him. Right now he's the director of security over Green Valley. And so he's worked with Station Casinos now for quite some time. And so in the security premise. So yeah, anytime he's around that area, pop into Green Valley, say hi.
Okay, great. We have another one. I don't mind my name being said. So it's Armando Walsh. My question for him is, what is the most profound lesson you've learned? Whether it's friendships, relationships, or just life in general, what one thing sticks out the most?
Oh, man, I could probably have a three-day conversation nonstop about different concepts that are all, it's hard to say. So one thing I live by now that I didn't when I was younger, and I think this would help a lot of people and a lot of people I train with, a lot of people feel that it's all or nothing. You know, they'll start a new diet on Monday, and then Tuesday they end up eating a donut for breakfast. Someone brings them into the you know, the office, and now they're like, screw it, I messed up, I'm just gonna go full bore and just burgers and pizza, and just the diet's over with. And I tell people that actually shouldn't be the mindset. Any percentage moving forward is still a percentage moving forward. So I always tell people, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. And at first, guys always look at me when I say that, kind of funny. I'm like, look, if you're having a bad day and you stay home in bed, you've made zero improvement, you step back. Even if you decide that, hey, I'm gonna go for a walk, I'm gonna go to the gym, or I'm gonna, you know, do something to enrich in my life and benefit and push myself in the forward direction. Even if it's only 1% in the direction you wanna go, at least you're that much better and it's not a step backwards. And so I'm big on that. I tell guys all the time, you know, they'll sit there and go, well, I didn't do this, or I'll start next week. No, you're already showing me that your mindset is that everything has to be perfect. Everything has to be lined up. And if anybody who's lived for any significant amount of time on the face of the planet knows that nothing ever works out perfectly. There's always going to be hiccups and, you know, late, or somebody didn't show up, and always kind of, you know, these distractions that if you're waiting for the stars to line up for you before you do things perfect, you're going to waste your whole life just hesitating, waiting to the right situation.
Yeah, well said, Frank.
So clearly, you and I both know, though, that of all your kids, your youngest has always been the best athlete. We'll put a shout out to Ronan Cage. You are number three of the three. Bella, I love you, kid. Known you a long time. You're two. But Ronan has always been the star for me. I hope Cage hears this and listens to it and understands that Ronan is far better than Cage is. You know, I've been around these kids for a long time. Our daughters played football together, competitive. Two of the only girls playing on highly competitive tackle football teams. You know, truth be told, my daughter Annabelle looks up to Bella. Loved the fact that she fought. She started training jiu-jitsu because Bella was doing jits.
That's cool.
Pretty cool. So, some of the things that we talk about for our cops is training. And there's two different aspects of training, I believe. There's the training our department gives you, because there's a lot of rules to the fight when you're a cop. You can't do this, you can't do that, unless you're in deadly force. But we don't train them a lot as far as the other side of the gamut on control and stuff like that. So maybe you could kind of give some guidance to our cops that, one, either think they're too old to do this stuff, they're already tough enough, that they don't need to learn anything new, that if they get in a fight, odds are they're going to win, even though they don't train or practice at all. They just think miraculously the switch is going to turn and they're just going to start beating people up. You know, maybe you could talk on that about how important it is for, you know, we look at college, continuing education.
Yeah.
Training is continuing education for our cops. I'm going to put up some stats in a little bit about our national law enforcement officers, how many attacks in 2019 have taken place, how many officers have been killed in the line of duty, and we're going to cover some videos and maybe have you break them down as a professional about what you see, because I have started training myself this year. I enjoy it. I love it. It helps keep you in shape. You learn a lot of really fun stuff. I myself have literally, last week I got beaten up by a 17-year-old high school kid who I outweighed by 100 pounds, had nothing to do with strength, size, age. He just better. And you humble yourself and you learn that. So walk us through a little bit about if you were to talk to a new cop or a new group of cops, how important it is for them to go out and get some real training.
Well, I think it would be essential. I think that besides just psychology of understanding how to talk to somebody and situational awareness, I would put your physical preparedness to enter into an altercation would have to be right there, because it's going to almost happen, I would think, daily or weekly, that you're going to have to grab somebody that doesn't want you to be grabbed, and they're going to resist. And if you are not training consistently, you're going to kind of be at a situation where you're going to have to escalate things and become more violent. I always tell people that, like, actually the advantage of being well-trained is that I don't have to really hurt people. You know, anytime I've been in an altercation, I'm able to subdue them, control them, and make it to where when the police show up, they're not looking at me going, hey, I realize you might have started out as the victim, but the guy's nose is sticking out of his ear. We got to take you now. You
know
what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, and I never wanted to be in that situation. So I've always felt that officers, for their own safety, it's like, well, why wouldn't you? You're not a garbage man. You're not an electrician. Your job is confrontation. You're going to be confronting people that don't like you. Why would you not want to be prepared physically and mentally with techniques to help you get through the situation much more effectively and safer for both of you? That's one thing I've never understood, that, like, okay, you want to dedicate your life, or I'll see guys that, you know, they'll go and they'll do firearm training. They like to go shoot, but I'm like, all right, you know, the chances of you getting into a shootout versus the chances of you having to wrench some guy's wrist back to put him in cuffs because he's fighting you. You know, what do you think is going to happen, you know, probability-wise, to a lot greater degree? So that's why I always tell guys, it's not hard. It keeps you in shape. It keeps you a different kind of mental confidence to constantly go through. It's fun. I mean, I think training and moving around and learning martial arts, if you're already a warrior-minded set of a person, mindset of an individual, I have to assume most officers have that in them already to begin with. And it's like, well, this only cultivates and accentuates that mindset. It makes you so much more effective. And the truth of the matter is, the UFC has changed the game. You know, there are a lot of kids out there right now that know how to fight extremely well, that if they get into a one-on-one altercation, you know, you're going to have a difficult time. You might get choked out and put to sleep. And now, you know, now what's going to happen? So I always tell people, like, even for my own kids who they love football, and obviously Bella's taking it to a greater step. I told Cage, you know, jokingly, because he's a really big, strong kid, I'm like, you know, you still can't move out to go to college until you get a blue belt in jiu-jitsu. Like, there's a bare minimum that you have to be able to protect yourself, that when someone goes, when you're in college and it's going to happen, oh, so who's your dad? And, you know, you're going to be pushed and tested. I don't want you to fail that test. I want you to feel confident in yourself and be able to protect yourself. And so learning martial arts, especially jiu-jitsu, I feel is such an effective way to get through life. It's an invaluable tool that you'll always have with you. It carries over many areas as far as mindset and health. It's really just I can't really see anybody arguing against, well, why they shouldn't train. If they tell me, well, I have injuries, I'm like, oh, that's even more important for you to train, because now you need to learn how to work your body in a situation. You can't sit there with a guy and if you have a confrontation say, hey, I got a bum knee, don't go to my left. Or hold on, my hand's messed up, don't squeeze it, please stop. They're not going to cooperate with you. But if you understand martial arts and you have regular training, and it's not something that you have to, you know, 5 days a week, 4 or 5 hours a day. Well, now you're trying to be a professional. But even somebody who trains 3 hours a week, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you train for an hour, learn a technique, apply it, do some rolling randori where you're moving around with people that are not really cooperating with, but allowing you to try to apply moves. That's just such a immeasurable amount of improvement you're going to be making. And again, I tell people, unless someone punches you from behind, if you have a certain level of proficiency in grappling, I tell people, if you train pretty rigorously for 6 months, you're not going to lose a fight against a guy who doesn't know. I don't care what the athleticism is, the size difference. It's just there's too much technique gap that now it makes size and strength irrelevant. Now, if we're talking about two guys that know how to fight and we're both trained martial artists, well, that's why we have weight classes. Now size is going to matter. You know, strength will matter. They will come in once skill's close enough. But if the skill is separated and it's too large of a gap to cross over, size and power is going to be meaningless.
And I think when you look at jiu-jitsu as opposed to karate and stuff like that, in law enforcement, a lot of what we do, if you showed video of me standing, throwing strikes to your head, elbows, kicks, that's going to look like excessive force.
Uh-huh.
There's not many times that we end up in that position. It's more controlling, getting close, controlling arms, controlling posture, getting people down and getting them in handcuffs. And what's your take on... for a cop, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu as opposed to, yeah, I'm going to go learn Muay Thai. I'm going to go learn this as it relates to the work you do.
Well, I think you nailed it right on the head. Is could you drop a knee into someone's gut and drop a few elbows and then subdue them and put them in cuffs?
It's actually a crime in New York right now. If you could believe that, to put pressure on the body of a person you're taking into custody is a misdemeanor crime now.
Wow.
So I don't know how you expect to control people, but it is literally a crime. There and we're hoping.
So you pin someone down.
So if you're on the ground and I've got to go knee to belly or on your lower back or whatever, and we don't train on your upper back, we low
right.
Pressure on the body is a crime.
That's crazy. All right, and they wonder why people get hurt when you start taking away valuable tools that are.
And we're going to talk about a valuable tool in what we call an LVNR.
Yep.
You would call a rear naked choke.
Yep.
People claim that it kills people. I'm going to gauge by your laughter that's not an accurate or fair assessment. But go ahead and continue to talk about taking away tools from folks.
Yeah, because look, you know, again, to go back to your question of like, you know, training Muay Thai versus, you know, or boxing versus a grappling-based art like, you know, jiu-jitsu, even college, you know, or folk-style wrestling that we use, I feel is a much more important tool for an officer because it enables control. You're controlling a situation. If I control you through blunt force trauma, yeah, I might get control over you, but then the damage that I'm causing, and now, you know, your intake photo, the guy has, you know, one eye sticking out this way and his face is bashed up. You know, there's attorneys out there like, all right, this is going to be a, you know, excessive force case I have on my hands. Whereas if you sit there and you're able to just joint manipulation, you put someone in an arm lock and you pin them and you understand how to make it to where they can't get to their feet because of the pressure you're putting on their chest and holding them down and a side control, you know, and able to turn them and I think, you know, the LVNR and now you can restrain them in a way that, you know, if they lose consciousness, it's not dangerous. And to go to that, I guess, leap right into it. I always laugh when they want to take away the ability for an officer to choke somebody. And I know that sounding an idea of being a choke sounds awful, but I tell people, like, look, choking is not dangerous. It really isn't. If that was the case, my children compete, and thousands and hundreds of thousands of kids compete all over the world in arts that involve grappling that have chokes in them. Jiu-jitsu tournaments, gi, no gi, hell, judo, very classical form of martial arts. You can choke people unconscious. No one's dying. Because everybody's of relatively good health. There's nobody who's methed out of their mind, jumping on the mat, who has a pre-existing condition because, you know, they're high. They're not on a bunch of Oxycontin where, like, well, yeah, you know, the choke probably didn't help the situation, but at the same time, that's not why that person is having, you know, respiratory failure. You know, he has narcotics. So that's why I always tell people, that's why we're drug tested for those in before a fight. If you came right now and I'm a month out from a fight and they come randomly drug test me, obviously they check for PEDs because they assist me. But I could be high on coke right there in front of the commissioner, and there's nothing wrong with it as far as my legality obligation to the fight commission. They don't ban you to take recreational drugs. But then that's called an out-of-competition drug test. But then when I become in competition, once I weigh in, I can't have cocaine, heroin, or, you know, marijuana in my system. And the marijuana now, they've changed a little bit where there's a certain amount of nanograms per liter.
Milliliter, sure.
Milliliters. But still, and the reason why they do that is because, well, it's not a performance enhancer, but if you're high and you walk in a cage and you have someone on top of you and you're stressing yourself out extremely, you're putting the pedal down on the metal, you're going to possibly cause harm to yourself. And so that's why that is the case. So it's really just a misunderstanding of what a choke is, or LVNR, or any kind of, you know, restraint on the neck when people look at it. And I tell guys this all the time. Once again, children do it all over the country. Thousands and thousands of kids are doing it all the time. If it was dangerous, no one would have us do it because it would be litigated to the end of the world. Could you imagine? It's like, oh, my kid did this jiu-jitsu tournament and you're telling me that four or five of these kids are dying a weekend? Our sport would not exist. It's super safe. That's why it's allowed to happen. Those chokes, in fact, in 6-year-olds are allowed to completely put themselves in a Matty Leon or a rear naked choke to finish an altercation or in a match with their competitor. So I get frustrated when I hear that officers now are not allowed to use an LVNR. And I even think that they should be allowed to use a full rear naked choke, because once you cut the blood off to the brain, it's just they lose consciousness momentarily. They're incapacitated for 10 to 15 seconds. Plenty of time to put a guy into cuffs, put him in a position where you're much safer. It's safer for him too, because what's the alternative? Pain compliance? You know what I mean? You know, you're going to drop elbows and stomping on people's wrists and trying to, like, give me your hand, and you're hitting the guy. Like, I don't know what else you're expected to do. In fact, that was one of the things that I really blame the situation I saw. I was in Georgia where the two officers were trying to apprehend the suspect who was just passed out inside of a car. There's no way that he's that, you know, he's not some NFL guy. It's like, all right, well, just an unbelievable 1% athlete, and he was ready to go. The guy could barely, he was passed out in his car. What kind of mental state was he in? But because they were trying to grab wrist and hold, and they're trying to do everything so delicately and not, you know, it caused him to be shot, because it had to escalate up to a level that, because he wasn't stopped at the beginning, he kept taking it further, and they had to follow and do due diligence. But it led to a tragic situation. And I stand by this now on record. If my son or daughter ever lost their mind, and you tell me that they have to be restrained by an officer, and they're like, well, how do you want it to happen? I'm all, oh, I hope they just choke him out. Put him to sleep real quick, put him in cuffs, and then, you know, let me get a hold of him now when he gets home. But if you'd say, well, they're going to do a pain compliance and beat the shit out of him, I'm like, well, it might tear a shoulder, your labrum's gone, you know what I mean? Like, now there's injuries with someone fighting back against that. Whereas with choking, there's just not, you know, just, and again, kids do it all the time. There's no way it's as dangerous as people think it is. It would be banned all over the world. We wouldn't be able to do it.
And we agree with you 100%. And it's a shame that the Nevada legislator and legislators across the country are banning police chokeholds, yeah, because it's the most effective tool that we can use to take a combative person into custody without hurting them.
Yeah.
And I think in the upcoming years, we're going to see an adverse effect of a lot more people, officers and citizens, getting hurt because we're not allowed to use them.
Well, and it's an education piece, right, Frank? So if you've got a 60-year-old lady listening to this podcast, you say choke. They think, can't breathe, food stuck in my throat.
Right.
What I see on TV is choking. It is violent. It's flailing around. It's petechia, hemorrhaging is going to start in my eyes. They think that's what choking is, and that'll segue us into what you did for us. And for those that don't know, Frank Muir was one of our key witnesses in one of our officers' cases. Officer Ken LaPera had a use of force case down at on the Strip, attempted to apply an LVNR rear naked choke on a subject, and Frank was instrumental as his expertise in chokes to testify on behalf of Ken LaPera to say that, no, he didn't kill this man. But at the time, I was dealing with the media, and a lot of people were like, choking is so bad. And so then you ask, well, do you know what the choke is? Well, yeah, you can't breathe. Okay, so you don't know. You're not educated. You have no understanding of it. I hate to say it, people on my own agency weren't doing us any favors by at least articulating what we mean by blood choke, wind choke. This was a blood choke application. And so for those that don't know, like I said, we're talking choke. We're talking about the blood cutting off to the brain. Yep. You still can breathe. You're still conscious and cognizant of what's going on until you go to sleep. Then you wake up and you're right back at it.
Yeah.
Talk us through what you did without specifics at the grand jury, and I don't know if we can edit that.
I'm looking to see if I get nods.
We have our sensor. Talk about what happened inside the grand jury. Yes, that's what I figured. Yeah.
Your impression of the case.
Right.
Yeah. We have David Roger here. He's a phenomenal attorney. He keeps us guided in the right direction. He's also our instrumental censor. Dan hates him because he censored him. Dan was going to stage a walkout and just quit the PPA altogether because of censorship, but he's going to power through. So without talking about the specifics in there, right. You and I reached out to you early on, and I brought you in, and I said, Frank, can you look at this and tell me your thoughts?
Yep.
So what's your thought of Ken's case?
Yeah, well, you called me up and you said, hey, I have a situation where an officer had attempted to put an LVNR, and he himself, you know, talking about maybe, you know, whether it was a rear naked choke or not. People are arguing, you know, what was this choke, and was, do you think it was, you know, instrumental in a fatality? And so, you know, I was like, oh, I'll take a look, you know, and basically with the agreement of like, well, I'll look at it. If I think it's straight up, I'll be honest. And you told me, yeah, and if you don't think that it's this is clean, if there's a problem, point out what the issues are and educate me on it. So I watched I sat there and I got to watch the YouTube video in your office. And when I watched the situation occurred, I'm like, guys, he doesn't have a choke. You know, and I explained what the choke was, and I explained the difference between air chokes and blood chokes. And then LVNR essentially is just half of a rear naked choke that what we call an MMA or the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world. Whereas, you know, you're using your elbow to line up with the chin so that you put your bicep and your radius bone on the carotid arteries, and it restricts it to where now there's not enough blood flow going to the brain, and your brain is the one unique organ that needs a constant supply. It doesn't store anything up. So the minute oxygen and glycogen are not going anymore, you know, upstairs, within seconds, you lose consciousness. And then the person lets the choke go because someone goes limp, and blood flow returns normal. I mean, it takes a long time to honestly, and I've watched fights where people have been stuck in a choke and they couldn't identify it, you know, 20 and 30 seconds, and still they were passed out longer once the choke was alleviated from them, but they still woke up, you know, obviously wondering why everybody was in their bedroom. they still woke up, gained consciousness, and there was no harm, no foul. So when I watched the situation with LaPera, I was like, wow, no, whatever you need to help, because I felt extremely bad that somebody who was just trying to restrain an individual and try to, you know, do things the right way was being, you know, crucified because of the misunderstanding of what a choke was. And the idea that people thought that, oh, this is a vicious, malicious move. And I'm like, no, honestly, it's not. It's a very humane way to actually incapacitate somebody and to take control of a situation. Whereas, you know, dropping a bunch of elbows on someone's head till they roll over and comply, that's bad. You know, I mean, I don't think we want to talk about the difference between a headshot, concussions, and bleed outs. Those are a much more regular occurrence. You know, people don't die in MMA where we have chokes. People die in boxing. Well, why? Because, you know, pugilistic, you know, damage, you know, shots to the head, they cause problems. You know, the human brain doesn't fare well when it takes a large concussive shot. You know, blood vessels burst, you have bleed outs, and you know, and that's much more detrimental. And again, if one of my kids ever had to be restrained, if I had to restrain one of my children in an altercation, they lost their mind, here's somebody I love more than life itself, I wouldn't hit them because I'm afraid of what kind of damage that could cause. I would take their back, put them to sleep, and then hopefully when they woke up, we had a reset party and we can talk this through.
Yeah, and so looking at the to talk about the case, and I remember the coroner found that asphyxia due to police restraint was one of the contributing factors, and we kind of debunked that there was any asphyxia. There was, again, no petechia hemorrhaging, no right. damage to the hyoid bone. It was not a, hey, I can't breathe type of deal, but they didn't highlight all that much the fact that he had an enlarged heart and had methamphetamine on board, that the perfect cocktail to yeah. say, violent encounter, raised heart rate, raised blood pressure, dope on board, weak heart is a cocktail for death probably. And it wouldn't matter if it was you, Lance Armstrong, who was training, put it all together, and that factor is probably going to potentially be the same end result.
And again, I'm not a medical professional, but I try to explain it. Like, there's a reason why. Remember back in the late 90s, ephedrine was a big thing. Everybody took ephedrine to burn fat, energy. Well, it was killing people because they were on a speed. Ephedrine raised their heart rate, raised their blood pressure, and they'd go out and do an activity, whether it was sprinting, running, you know, lifting. And now they put their body under an extreme amount of duress, and they had a heart attack. The body couldn't keep that load. And that is what I felt happened to the Tashi Farmer. Was it like, look, he had methamphetamines in his body. He already had an enlarged heart, and the guy wasn't in shape. So all of a sudden, he's in a full-blown fight trying to resist being arrested for, you know, close to 2 minutes. Different officers grabbing him, fighting him. He was in a sprint. Basically, if I chased him with a car for, you know, 120 seconds, his heart rate's maxed out. He's going to grab his chest, and no one would look at that crazy. I think most people can picture that in their head. I'm like, yeah, if you do meth and you go and you hit a really hard workout, you're taking your life in your own hands. You know what I mean? There's a chance that you pop a valve, you know, like your body just, it overbears too much burden on your heart. And, you know, you see that happen very commonly. And that's why I try to explain to people that in this situation specifically, because of the movement that, you know, that Tashi had and was moving around, I'm showing that. And then, you know, nothing against LaPera, you know, but, you know, he was shit at putting a choke on. Like, he didn't actually ever do it. Had he done it properly and had trained a little bit more regularly, we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
You and I talked about that. It was funny because I remember that, and you said, listen, this guy sucks.
Yeah.
No offense, Kenny, if you listen, but Frank is a professional, looking at it going, like, you never even had an actual rear naked at all. You may think you didn't, but it was horrible. You were commentating it and picking it apart as I asked you, but it was funny to say, none of this played, like, this guy would have never went to sleep. No. Have you ever put on a good rear naked and it took a minute and 45 seconds to put someone out?
And that's basically what LaPera had done in the altercation. When he finally took Farmer's back, I think he had his back for, 90 seconds in the video that you can see on YouTube, and he's essentially hugging his head. He hugged his head for 90 seconds. That's why the other officers had to come in, and there was still a response coming from Farmer because he was very much conscious. I will bet every dollar I've ever made and every dollar I'll ever make. There's nobody in the world that if I put a choke on, you're lasting 6 seconds, let alone 60 seconds. It's impossible. Basically, that tells me that you think you can run around with your head cut off. Like, once the blood flow stops to the brain, function ceases. You know, you lose consciousness. And so there is no fighting back, you know. In fact, the only reason why sometimes in fights we don't know when a guy's choked out and you have a professional referee looking is because some guys will try to relax and just, you know, they'll find it's almost like they're fighting that gap in a flooded room, just that little crease of air, and they got their lips pressed up against it. They're trying to survive. So you'll see guys sometimes in a combat situation in an MMA fight where they're not moving, they're in the choke, and it's like, well, they're not being choked out, but they found a gap, just enough blood flow, and they're just kind of waiting the guy out so that his biceps, you know, if he chokes too much with his arms, hopefully he gets tired of it not applying and removes it. He's never fighting, though. He's not resisting. The confusion comes in that it also is the way someone looks like when they're passed out. You lose consciousness and you kind of sit there, your eyes are open, the lights got turned out, you know what I mean? And they'll come over, grab the hand, lift it, oh, the guy's out. But I tell everybody, I'm like, you're not going to show me a fight where someone's asleep in a choke and they're still throwing shots. They're still punching the guy. It just, you know, we're not cockroaches. We need our brain for the rest of us to work, you know?
Well, and even as Kenny, like you talked about too, is as a professional at this, who does this all the time, and I have rolled a little with Frank, and let me be very clear, he is very good at what he does. Just to be able to keep the pressure on your own side of a rear naked, your arms will start to fatigue and drop out. And a lot of times the guys, when they're doing it, will realize, hey, it's been about 10 seconds. Either I got to readjust,
100%.
But I can't keep cranking here because it would have been over already.
Yeah. That's why actually I'm not a fan of wind chokes, where you put pressure on the esophagus. One, they can be slightly dangerous because if, you know, you get a guy who's slightly dehydrated or just freak accident, you know, the esophagus is cartilage and there is a chance that you can crush it in. I've never seen it happen. I only have experience through somebody else who got into an altercation, did a what we call a palm-to-palm choke, which puts the forearm, the radius bone, in the throat, and they had to give the guy a tracheotomy to open him up. So, like, you know, he did 6 months for it. So I know somebody on a personal level that that happened to. So I try to avoid it. Sometimes when I'm rolling for the sportive effect, I might squeeze on your throat because a lot of people don't like that sensation, and they'll tap extremely quick. In a situation where tapping, it's not sportive, I would never go for a wind choke, because my ability to squeeze on your throat to cut off oxygen and hold maximum squeeze, that was one thing I tried to talk about in the thing where they're like, well, he had a choke for 90 seconds. I'm like, guys, I'm a world-class professional fighter. I can't squeeze someone for 90 seconds. 20 seconds is pretty impressive, top-notch. Randy Couture could squeeze for about 30 seconds, and we all thought he was a god. Like, that just give you an idea of the conditioning level. So you're telling me that LaPera, you know, didn't look anything like Randy. Sorry, dude. that now he can squeeze for 90 seconds and not let any blood flow. And that was the other thing I tried to bring up, that, like, you guys don't realize that's why we have to be so efficient with our chokes, and it takes training, is because it's like squeezing a hose. The minute I let go, all the blood flow goes right back. So if you adjust a choke and you're not doing it properly, it resets to zero. It isn't like, well, the guy was being choked out for 90 seconds. Like, no, he was getting his head squeezed for about 2 seconds here, and then another 2 seconds there, and then another 2 seconds there. That can go on until someone goes, you know, indefinitely. That's not going to do anything. Now, if a person has a full-blown, tight, 100% choke on, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, now we got to start the clock. They're going to go out. And, you know, and again, a rear naked choke you could possibly hold for a little bit longer because you're using so much frames of your arms and your chin and your
shoulders. Yeah.
Whole body, your legs are wrapped around the waist, you're pulling up. So you can really apply a lot. That's why it's such a clean power. I mean, that's why in Brazil, you know, in Portuguese, they call it a mata leão, right? It's a lion killer, because it's such an effective technique that you could take out a lion, is essentially what they're saying, because it's so powerful. It's the most powerful choke that I know of. And because it's so powerful, the reason why I train it in my martial arts, even for a street altercation, it's my ultimate idea is to get to that area. Because breaking someone's arm, hey, there's guys with different pain tolerance, man. There's guys you can break their arm and they're going to hit you with it, you know? There's guys that, you know, you can hit. I fought guys like that, like a Roy Nelson type, where I'm like, you can hit that guy in the head with a hammer and he's going to smile at you. You ain't knocking him out. I don't care what you think. But nobody is able to toughen their throat. You go to sleep with a choke, and then because you're incapacitated, the way I look at it is like, well, I'm safer, you're safer. You know what I mean? Like, I like that, especially too, as a civilian, I have to think about the civil side of situations. I could have been very much right defending myself, but now someone, you know, I hurt somebody in the process of defending myself. And now, you know, the burden of guilt is a little bit different in civil court than it is in criminal. Now I'm, you know, now I have a lawsuit on my hands, you know?
And Frank, you said something earlier about the 6 seconds. You can choke anybody out in 6 seconds if you sink it in. We have a guy up here, John Abel. He wanted to be part of the show. He kind of ruined the stunt. Maybe we can bring him down for the demonstration. It's okay with David.
Yeah, could we see if John is willing to come down and get choked out? That, I mean, he screwed up the Pocky Chip Challenge for this episode. If we could choke him out on TV, I think our viewership would go through the roof.
Yeah,
look at that. And how many times can you say I've been choked out by the heavyweight champion of the world, Frank Mir? I mean, it doesn't happen all that much. And funny you talk about the wind choke. You jinxed me. So you and I were rolling at Drysdale Jiu-Jitsu. And we'll throw a couple plugs out here. Drysdale Jiu-Jitsu, Syndicate, Extreme Couture. If you're looking for a place to go train as a cop, these are all great places. I've been to pretty much all of them. Great people. You would think there's attitudes in gyms. Wow. There's not. You know, I went in there as a 40-year-old fat guy. And the people are the nicest people around. If you have an attitude, they'll have one back. But if you're in there,
it'll be fixed.
Yeah, very quickly. And you see it. You see the kid come in that wants to be a fighter, that tries to go 100% on the mat. And then an instructor comes over and goes, hey, let me and you roll. And then all of a sudden they learn, hey, there's some humble pie. But we were there and we were talking about wind chokes. And you said, hey, I had one where for a week my throat hurt. It was like a really bad sore throat. No crap. We rolled on a Friday. Saturday, I went into Couture's, and a kid got me in a front guillotine choke.
Yeah.
Have my head trapped, and it was right on the throat. week and a half, like, I couldn't swallow. It sucked. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't dead, but, yeah, it sucked a lot.
Eating steak sucks.
Yeah. So we want to – well, when Adela gets back here, I want to just put up a couple videos. For you, though, before we get to that, what do we look forward to with Frank? What do you got coming up?
Well, Bella has another fight December 11th, and I actually went down to Miami just this past weekend because this new sport of bare-knuckle boxing has really piqued my interest. I want to go out there and compete because, look, I mean, with 20 years now professional fighting, I've shown my prowess in being able to choke people, to be able to put them in submissions, and I have knockouts, but obviously they're overshadowed by my submission prowess. So I want to go out there and compete now in this form of combat. Really, honestly, I'm very selfishly wanting to go out there and be like, hey, look, I'm a great rifleman. I'm not going to have access to my rifle now. So now I'm going to show you how good I can be with my sidearm. And that's essentially what I'm doing, is I'm going to go out there in a competition where I have to use skills that I've used in MMA, but without, you know, let's face it, even when I'm doing striking, I've knocked out Verdum and Chuck Congo, or not Verdum, excuse me, Krokop, you know, with a knee and whatnot, you know, Nogueira, I still had the safety net of
Wes
knowing.
Wes Sims, good knockout. Yeah,
I had the safety net of knowing I have grappling in my toolbox. So it was there. You know, it'd be like using multiple weapon systems, but the weapon system you're best with is still on your back. You're ready to go. You can pull it at any time. Where with the bare knuckle boxing, you can grapple on your feet from the clinch as long as you're striking, but there is no, I can't take someone down and choke them or you know, put them in a position where I can rest for a second. They're 2-minute rounds. You have to start right in front of each other. In fact, the night I was there, there was a 3-second knockout because you essentially start face to face. They call it toeing the line. So there's another big event February 5th that I know that Paige VanZant is headlining, trying to maybe get on that card or one relatively quick. And so that's what I've been training a lot. I still do MMA training 3 days a week at the gym because of Bella and keeping those skill sets up, because essentially it's still very important for a real fight. And then the other 2 days I've been working on the bare knuckle boxing stuff, which I like it. It's a lot of fun. It's cool.
And where could a cop accidentally run into you training at?
Well, I'm at Syndicate usually Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday at 11:30 in the pro class. So anytime you want to come in, you know, especially if we're warming up or after class, if you want to pick my mind and, you know, pick my brain and ask me some questions about what's going on, points of advice, easy to go. And then I go a lot to Greg's gym, which is a Drysdale gym, but it's by my house over on Ann Road. It's a Zenith. It's an affiliate school with, you know, Greg is one of Drysdale's closest friends in black belt. So.
Nice. It looks like we have John down here.
The challenger.
Would you rather do the Pocky next podcast rather than getting choked out by Frank?
I'd rather do the
I think.
The choking doesn't hurt, man.
Shoulder on live TV.
You what?
No.
I've seen him break a man's shoulder on live TV, so I'd rather do the Becky Chip challenge.
That was all staged. I mean, that was, it was like.
It was a work.
Yeah, totally. You know, that guy actually walked out of there no issues at all.
I'm sure.
All right, well, John chickened out. He screwed up the Pocky challenge, and now he's afraid to get choked out by Frank. How about just a leg kick?
No.
Deep to the thigh.
I'm pretty sure I would be hopping the rest of my life. I'm
pretty sure that's
and
what...
And actually, if I was you, I would choose the choke over the leg kick.
Wait to fuck this up. Don't say that. No,
trying to get him to choke.
No, I want to see him. I'd rather see him get kicked.
I'm just all around disappointed in John lately. He ruined the show twice right now.
Yeah, it's okay. We'll see if he can go for three next podcast. So the first video, can you see the TV way back there, Frank?
Yeah,
your eyes good? And we'll I know you got another interview. And we appreciate your time.
The Bella has to be with me, so I'm just coordinating that she's going to.
Okay. So this is one of our local cops, actually. Made some pretty big headlines. He goes out on a guy. He's patting him down. He's got him in typical setup, control of the hands, checking the pockets. And as it happens most often, opportunity, the cuffs were out, and he goes.
He fell on his head.
So go ahead and commentate us through this one, Frank.
Well, right now the officer basically has mount. He's gotten his head up. And see, now this is a great position to control. His weight is on his stomach. He's grapevining with his legs. He's keeping his arms out so he doesn't get swept over. And because
Adela, pause it.
The officer, the individual on the bottom, you can't generate power. So even if he right now decides to not hug because he's basically being defensive, thinking that the officer is going to try to rain down shots, but you can see with your officer staying tight to him, which that's jiu-jitsu, it alleviates striking, you know, and you're putting people at mechanical disadvantages. That's what martial arts is. How can I leverage my body to the greatest asset, and how can I take away your strength and speed and ability to do me damage or harm? And what now we have, it was actually a decent, you know, takedown and back take. And the only thing that, you know, the officer that was kind of dangerous is when he took the guy down, he tackled, he kind of rolled to his head. And just for his own health benefit, that could hurt. But I mean, that wasn't a lack of technique. That was just, he was in a scramble, and, you know, as they say, shit happens.
Now, right now here, Frank, so what would you, you know, a lot of people would try and hold, like, the cop's head down. We, of course, have that tool belt on, right? And you and I have talked about you maybe doing some seminars and some teaching for cops, because it's not just a street fight. There are a bunch of tools in play. Knives, tasers, batons, our gun. So as most times, our best bet is to create distance and try and, whether we go to a tool, a taser, or whatever, or try and wait for other units. But so if the guy's holding you down by the back of the neck, you can't get distance. What's a good way to create some distance between you two right here?
Well, what we do, what the, I would tell the officer to do, the same thing that I would do in an MMA fight, or what I would yell out to Isabella, and actually yelled that out to Bella. It's called a frame. I would now put my forearm on the other side of between he and I, so that I can extend my hand and create distance. And the way the human body is built, I can, just about anybody can bench press much more than they can row. It's just more difficult. You know, that's why you'll see guys benching 300 pounds. You don't see a lot of guys doing pull-ups. It's more difficult. So my ability to press away from you to create room is a mechanical advantage over your ability to try to hold. Plus, too, the pushing's less fatiguing than the pulling. The biceps are filling up with blood. And once I created enough space, I would tell the officer, like, you just need to do an elbow pass. I would pass the elbow so that now my opponent's arms are both on the same side of my body, so that when I crunch back down and take up space, they don't have access with their hands to anything on my belt, because that would turn a situation where I'd have to go lethal. If I felt, as an officer, someone was trying to go for my firearm, you've just changed the dynamics of our encounter. You know, you went from someone who's resisting to someone who's making an attempt to kill me, and who knows who else. You know, there's no other reason to go for a firearm except for lethal force.
And we say that a lot. So the term de-escalation is used a lot across the country. Sometimes escalating violence is actually de-escalating the entire scenario.
100%.
Right? If I can punch a guy in the face and knock him out, that meant he never had the opportunity to get to his weapon, my weapon, and I potentially have to kill him.
Yep.
He lives to see another day.
100%.
I'm not getting going through scrutiny. And a lot of cops don't get that sometimes escalating your violence would actually de-escalate what we're going through. And let's go ahead and finish that off, Adela.
Nip it in the bud, right?
Yeah.
See, that was a mistake the officer made there, was he didn't keep his hands out wide. So I would say, in any grappling situation, obviously if you're a very superb grappler, bottom isn't going to matter. But I would always want to stay on top in these kind of situations, because again, he has the advantage. Now he elbow passed. He essentially did it through striking. You've seen how now the opponent, the guy on bottom, put his arm across the body. And here now he can transfer over to, I guess, a lower lethality with the taser. But again, now see, he basically elbow passed him again. That gives you the back. And if someone's face down and you're sitting on their hips, most people don't know how to build a base or create any type of, and here he's got a head and arm choke. Yeah. And again, if he was allowed to go for that choke, and I don't know what policy is if that's allowed, I put people out extremely fast with that. And now if someone goes to sleep, now this guy is not getting hit anymore. But the longer he's awake and the longer he's resisting, the more strikes he's taking. So to me, if you want to be humane, you want every police officer to be a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Guess what? That'd be a really humane law enforcement, because a lot of department, because people would just be getting passed out, handcuffed, and be like, who got hit? They're like, nobody. No one got hit once. We didn't have to, you know?
The I believe it's the chief of police up in Reno. He is actually either a purple belt in jiu-jitsu or blue, but he loves to train, and he's actually having his officers training in that because of the control aspect as opposed to the punching aspect.
Yep.
And like you said, clear shot, has his back, could have encircled, even an LVNR could have gotten proper hand placement and could have ended that thing. Instead, it could escalate even more. Luckily, he gets some backup officers there, and they're able to take the guy into custody. This video is a little different, and this kind of maybe goes toward, hey, you probably need to learn something. There are officers out there that go right to a handgun. You can't always shoot people. Oh, no, that's the next one.
It's the surveillance one with the officer that you got someone, nothing in their hands, coming out, but they're not compliant. We have this over-reliance sometimes to pull a gun all the time. You can't shoot that person. Unless there's some justifiable factors. And so this one, I believe it's a burglary suspect. The officer that's leaning on the railing, here comes in contact. Person appears, nothing in their hands. He's got his gun out. Old school move. Little shot to the face with a little butt stroke.
But, I mean, see, now right there.
It's a lethal action move.
That actually scares me for the officer because, look, he basically, I feel like once you – it's hard to go backwards. If I pull my firearm out, now we get into a grappling situation. It's kind of hard to, like, okay, well, how do we go backwards? I escalated it up to – I thought my life was in danger, so I pulled my firearm. Okay, well, he doesn't have a weapon. What are you going to do? And now you have a gun in your hands, and you've actually limited your ability to fight. Great improvisation that he actually used it as a weapon, but the problem is with hitting people is that if you hit a guy and you knock him out on his feet, he's not in a ring. You're not in a cage right now. That's concrete that people are going to fall down and hit. And so you hit a guy, knock him out, and then he slams his head on the concrete. We've seen that many times now when people, for that while, that trend where people were sucker punching guys, you know, walking around, people were dying. You know, like people don't realize, you know, you're 6 feet tall and you lose consciousness and you go slamming your face on the ground. That's bad. You know, I don't think it takes, I mean, do the math. You know what I mean? Like, that's a lot of trauma to the head, and now you're responsible for that. So that's why, again, I'm not a big proponent of hitting people in a street fight situation because of the repercussions of what could happen. Obviously, if it gets to the point where you're escalating it, well, then, you know, you have to do what you have to do to survive a situation. But it shouldn't be your go-to.
David is a district attorney. Did you ever prosecute a case where somebody pushed or punched another subject, they fell, hit their head, and died or had some trauma?
Yeah, we prosecuted a firefighter who was involved in a fight and knocked the guy out and killed him.
It was in a bar, right? The guy hit his head on the stool, like Hurricane Harry's or something like that?
I think you could be right. It was a number of years
ago. Yeah.
And very, very sad case because there were just two drunks in a fight. Nobody intended to kill the other person. And, you know,
sure. And if that didn't come through, David talked about a case when he was the DA that a fireman got in a bar fight and hit the guy. The guy fell. Frank seems to recall the case at one of the local bars, and the guy died. And while they worked out and resolved the case, I'm assuming he's no longer a fireman. Lost his career, lost his job, and over what? Over a bar fight where maybe you could have. Again, going back to the jiu-jitsu and the control side of things, in that same instance, taking someone down to the ground or created distance, or, hey, listen, even in our profession, this is a great career we have, great pension afterwards. It's okay to just walk away sometimes too. I'm sure you, Frank, get challenged quite often by people thinking that they're drunk. I can take a shot at you. You're not that tough. And we don't see your name in the paper for getting in bar fights, and I'm sure it happens.
Yeah, no, I mean, I tell people – you know, because some guys will have a couple drinks, and the way they look at it, it's like, wow, I'm going to go out there and have a chance to, you know, to go hit on, you know, Clemens in his heyday. It's like, well, if you get struck out, no one thinks anything of it. They're like, yeah, of course he struck you out. He's a professional baseball player, a Hall of Famer, you know. But if you can clip one, or you just happen to, you know, get in an altercation with me and you bloody my nose, even if you get beat up, like, that's still like a feather in some guy's cap. They're like, well, see, I lasted this long, or I got a couple shots in and whatnot. But, and the thing, too, that I would say to people in that situation, like the firefighter, like not only did he have to deal with, you know, the career choices and the social aspects of what was going on, you know, and the prospect of losing his freedom, but now because of an altercation where you just were pissed at somebody, you didn't really hate them. It wasn't like you woke up and they were in your kid's bedroom at 2 a.m. You took a guy's life. You know, you now have killed somebody. And, you know, I think the average human, unless it's necessary, doesn't desire to do that. You know what I mean? Not to have that on their consciousness. I mean, I have friends in the military that suffer with the aspects that they've taken life, and they were shooting at them first. So, I mean, even in a situation where I had to defend myself, and I still lose sleep about it. So, once again, you know, swinging at someone's head in a fight as your go-to, I just see, I can I can sit here all day and tell you the reasons why I think it's a bad idea. And even if you still use striking arts, I still hit, you know, but you know, there's shots to the solar plexus, the body, you know, to the leg, you know, a roundhouse to the quad. I've de-escalated situations that way. Guy falls down holding his leg. He's completely fine.
And, John, yeah, you know, see, and, you'd be completely fine.
You know, he might walk with a limp for a couple of days and have a cool story, but there was very little chance of any kind of, you know, greater bodily harm.
A technique I learned when I was young, my older brother Brian, who works for me now, used a technique of, if I punch you on top of the head, mom and dad will never see the bruising. So that's an effective tool also. If you just get hit on the head and then your opponent has hair, it's not a big deal. Frank, what's the oldest, because you hear this a lot, listen, I'm too old to do this stuff. What's the oldest person you've seen rolling, training, doing stuff to kind of dispel that rumor that, hey, you don't have to be 25 and go do jiu-jitsu and learn something new?
Well, I still train with my dad. My dad still comes to the gym and moves around with us. My dad's 63 now. So, you know, and now he might not be the best example because he's extremely fit, you know. You know, the guy wakes up every morning at 4:30 and goes for a 5-mile run. You know, I mean, that's, you know, Monday through Sunday, you know. But there's guys in the gym that train. A majority of the guys in a jiu-jitsu gym are over 40. You know, there's a ton of us that are that old, you know, that are older. And we just, you know, as long as you approach training intelligently, you're not trying to win the Super Bowl, you know, and not endangering yourself, you know. Rolling in the gym is such a safe way to fight hard because we can go super hard. You can resist my techniques. And the minute I succeed, you say stop, tap, break. And the technique stops, and there's no damage, there's no harm, there's no foul. That's why you see guys rolling well into their older age. I mean, there's guys, I mean, you know, I've never personally trained with anybody, but you see videos of guys in the 70s able to move around and use techniques and move and maneuver. You know, I mean, hell, there was old photos, you know, video of Elio Gracie in his 90s still rolling with the his children. So that being said, age, obviously, look, you know, and I tell people, the problem is kind of what I said earlier about the anything worth doing poorly, you know, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. Some people feel like, well, if I'm not going to try to be a professional fighter, why would I go in the gym and train? I'm like, man, that is a huge gap. That's like, again, like, you know, well, we're not going to have music anymore in our school systems unless you plan on being a rock star. If you're going to go and become a rock star, then you could take music class. But if it's that, it's all or nothing. I'm like, well, actually, I don't know. I think learning how to play the piano is probably good in a lot of ways as far as, you know, what it does for your brain and different, you know, mathematics and whatnot. So training is the same way. When you go in the gym, you just want to be better than what you were when you walked in there. It's not about beating everybody up. It's not about being the best guy on the mat, because guess what? That revolves every day. Some days I'm the best guy on the mat. Some days I'm not. You know what I mean? I just, oh, I got caught with that. This move, I got thrown, swept. You know, if you're competing against guys at a high level and you're training, well, you're going to make yourself vulnerable. You're going to open up yourself to techniques and maneuvers and put yourself in, you know, undesirable situations so that you can train better and become a better martial artist, which makes you a better human being. So, you know, things are going to happen, you know, where it's not every day you're going to be King Kong. So when guys talk about their age or physical limitations, it's more in your head than it is in reality. You can get in and do something. I mean, hell, I go to the gym all the time and I have injuries from years of fighting. Right now, I'm dealing with a little bit of a hamstring issue. Well, I sparred yesterday, but I sparred with a guy that knew that, hey, I'm a little bit injured here, so when we move around, you know, if you dance around me, it's going to be a very boring sparring session. I can't come after you. But if you want to, you know, basically go toe-to-toe, we can move in the pocket, you know, and no takedowns as far as from the waist down. Let's just do trips and body locks and do upper body kind of Greco wrestling. So I adjusted my training so that I got something out of it, still got my heart rate up, still improved as a martial artist, and hid the fact that, hey, man, my knee doesn't feel great. I can't take a shot on you. And if you take a shot on me, I'm just going to pull guard, you know.
And Chad Lyman, our own use of force guy, yeah, with the PPA, you know, he trains daily, coaches. He's 162 years old, you know, so there's age doesn't matter. I
actually have a hard time telling how old Chad is.
162, no, for sure. 162, it's been proven. We did the genealogy stuff, and they actually traced him back to
rings and shit.
Yeah. So, you know, so if you think at 50, you can't do it. Like I said, 163 years old, he'll be 180 next month.
Yeah. And you come in and you're 50 years old and you tell me you want to fight professionally, you're going to quit your job, tell your wife to go ahead and pick up extra shifts and you're going to not see your kids, I'm going to tell you you're crazy. Like, that's just not realistic. But if you're like, hey, my ability to fight is probably a 2. Do you think I can get to a 6? I'm like, absolutely. You can get to a 6. Will I be a 10? No, you'll never be a 10. I'm sorry, you know, you're never
sounds
going
like
to
how
be a
I'm,
10.
Sounds you know? Like how I'm judged by my looks. I'm a 6, I'll never get to a 10. Wife says typically you're a 3. You know, we move from there. So, listen, we had you on here for a long time. We appreciate you coming on here. We look forward to seeing you fight in the future. You're an old dear friend of mine, and I can't wait for the day that you kind of hang it up and you can just sit around and smoke a stogie without having to worry about keep training.
Me too.
You know, we do appreciate it, and we're actually looking into building a gym here at the PPA office, and so one of the things that we had talked about was bringing in folks like yourself potentially to put on some seminars for our cops in uniform, in their gear, so they can learn things to keep themselves safer. Because as we talked, I talked about earlier, numbers, and hopefully this hits home for some of you folks. 2019, 135 officer deaths. In 2018, there were 60,632 officers assaulted. 18,300 resulted in injuries. It's just getting worse. The numbers continue to increase. People get bolder and bolder and want to take a shot at a cop. It's not like it used to be where people were afraid to do that crazy shit. And, you know, you need to prepare yourself for that one violent encounter. And it may be only one in your whole career, but you need to want to feel confident that when it comes, that you at least have some skill set. And, you know, any parting words for our cops, for our, and also, too, for anyone listening, again, like I said, we use Frank as an expert in our use of force case with Kenny LaPera. If you ever want to reach out to the PPA and potentially use Frank, there's been a group out in New York that actually reached out to him, the Sheriff's Benevolent Association. And so if you have any interest in using him, because during that case, the prosecutors tried to bring in an expert in jiu-jitsu, and it was funny when he came off the stand and you're walking in, and we finally learned that that was their expert who had really no knowledge compared to what you had.
No.
It's you have to be willing to go out and get the experts, spend the money to defend your cops, and put no price tag on how you're going to do it.
Yeah, no, I tell everybody, hey, look, I say this to everybody, whether you're a civilian or an officer, you train. And it's that much more important for an officer. If you're 50 pounds overweight, you can barely walk up a flight of stairs, you know, you're selfish, you know what I mean? Because you're going to get hurt. You're not going to be an asset to society. And, you know, as an officer, your job is to serve, you know? And I feel that being a healthy warrior and training, there's nothing but upside, you know, in every way for what it does for your mind, body, spirit. It could be a place to, you know, alleviate pressure. How many times have you gone down and roll because you're stressed out and just, you can kind of, you know, roll your problems away. And the benefits are that you'll probably come out on top in a situation at a higher statistic. So there's more of a chance of you making it home safely, and also the people that you're working with come home safely, you know, or go to jail safely. And so, to me, if you're a police officer, it's a crime. You don't have a membership at a gym and not train at least once or twice a week.
And before you go, Frank, I won the lottery today in Arizona. I was feeling a little generous, so I picked up some Black Rifle coffee. They have new espresso mocha in the can. If anybody's not familiar, Black Rifle coffee is the official sponsor of police officers everywhere. So I'd like to give it a taste real quick.
And our unofficial sponsor, they still don't know that they are.
Yes. I gunned mine down. It was good.
It's pretty good.
It's really good,
really
actually.
Up front, you know, mocha taste. On the back end, kind of tastes like freedom. So
now, you got to
thumbs up.
Turn your product labeling. You got to drink right hand. There you go. That's, you know, you got to keep it out. Nice job. Frankie, again, appreciate your time, brother. Really appreciate it. And I know our cops do. And we look forward to maybe having you on again.
Absolutely, man.
Thanks, pal.
All right.
Thank you, Frank.
111 110 24.